It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Our next guest is a best-selling author of epic fiction, though words such as best-selling and epic, I suppose, don't really do justice to either the scale of his success or the scope of his tales. He has over 21 million books in print covering any number of fields, and his work has spawned computer games, graphic novels, and untold numbers of devoted fans. He will be appearing at Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing this Wednesday, September 8th at 7 p.m. to talk about and sign his new book, Bearers of the Black Staff, part of the Legends of Shannara series. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, Mr. Terry Brooks. How are you, my friend?
Good. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Bearers of the Black Staff takes place 500 years after the Great War that destroyed huge sections of the human race, which is about 1,500 years before Sword of Shannara begins. Did you always feel that you would explore this kind of prehistory? Was it inevitable to you?
Well, I did sort of feel it was inevitable after almost 30 years, really, of having readers ask me when I was going to go back and write about the prehistory of this world. It's become a little difficult to keep it all straight, though, because I started in what would be the middle of the whole thing and worked my way forward. Now I'm going backwards and working my way forward from the beginning towards where I left off, and I'm also writing in the future, so I hope someone can keep it straight.
Do you ever feel, just as a creator, as an artist, that you are reaching the outer edges of what you can do with the world, that whether it's figurative or literal, that the constraints of the world you've created have, you know, you were starting to get to those points of demarcation?
I think mostly it has to do with how much can I take, you know, before I say, well, geez, that's all enough. And I really think that my current plan is to write a total of about 10 books in that prehistory, and I'm just finished with 5. So I maybe will do 5 more there, and I'll do a few more in the future. And I really think I'll have tapped that well dry and need to then move on to something else. But it'd probably take me another 10 years.
Have you seen this landscape so clearly since the beginning, from the outset? Could you see the scope of it?
Oh, no. No, you know, I get asked that quite a bit, actually, and it's a good question because I'm not sure about other writers who have large, sprawling worlds like the Shannara world, and I think when I was starting out, Rick, I was like everybody else in this business, and, you know, I just wanted to get a book sold. I wanted somebody to show enough interest that I could maybe make a life out of this, and I was working from book to book for really the first 3, and then after that I began to think about it in the larger scope.
Sci-fi fantasy obviously has, to put it mildly, a very devoted fan base, and they, for good and bad, I would imagine, take a sort of ownership over the properties. Is fan input something that you have to very consciously define in your own head in terms of the amount of influence it has? In other words, is it difficult to keep that from filtering into your creation?
You know, I've always taken the approach that the books are mine until they're completed. And once they're completed and they're out there, they're like your children that you raise up. And you do the best to teach them what they need to know and to inform them. And then you turn them loose in the world and they make their own lives. And I kind of think that's the way it is with the books. And I tell the fans when they ask me about things that about the books, I say, look, I don't know. You own that book now. It's your book. You figure it out. And I really do feel like it's up to them to meet me halfway. And if they love the books enough, they'll find ways to determine what they ought to mean. On the other hand, of course, they want you to do certain things and develop certain things. And I listen to that, but, you know, I'm not influenced tremendously by what other people want because I've always written these books for myself first. It's not to say I'm not conscious of what they're thinking or disrespectful of it. It's just that I really have to satisfy myself first.
Actually, this dovetails with another question that I was going to ask, which is that when you're dealing with something that is such a sprawling, multi-decade epic, do you consciously work to surprise the audience so that they never quite know what's around the bend, or are you more of a writer who lets things unfold organically?
No, I think that surprising the readers is a part of the game, the writing game, when you're writing stories like I'm writing, which are essentially adventure stories cloaked in fantasy trappings. I'm very, very intent on finding ways to catch the reader off guard. And, you know, if they come back and say to me, wow, I didn't see that particular event coming, then I know I've done my job. And I think it's those are the kinds of books I like, so I like to write those books. And it takes some time and effort to get it right, but I think the result is worth it.
When you look back at the early books that you wrote, what do you think? What is the word that leaps to mind when you think of those first few novels?
Wow, that's a tough one. You know, they were pretty raw, number one. And that's, I think, a good and bad thing. When you're writing in a vacuum, and I really was at that time because I had no real formal training. I didn't know anybody in the publishing business. I didn't know any other authors. I'd had no, other than standard schooling, I'd had no real preparation for this sort of thing. So, you know, when you're writing in something of a vacuum, what comes out is very raw. And it was good because I think my expectations were wide open, and what I was prepared to try to do wasn't hindered in any way. It wasn't as good because, of course, the writing wasn't as good back then. I think I'm a much better writer now than I was when I started out. But the storytelling was just as good, and I kind of think maybe that's what drew readers to Sword of Shannara and Elfstones and Wish Song back in the beginning.
You've spoken of finding your way, or perhaps feeling that your destiny had become clear after reading Tolkien. If you hadn't been exposed to Lord of the Rings, would you have eventually honed your craft in some of the other genres where you were working, in Westerns and things?
That's a good question. You know, I don't know. I haven't really thought that through. I think that's entirely possible. I think I would have written some form of adventure story. I don't think there's much question about that. But you know, what was deeply impacting me before Tolkien was the European adventure story writers, Robert Louis Stevenson, Alexander Dumas, and that whole multi-generation in the 1900s and 1800s who were writing in that format. They were writers who I really admired and whose stories really captivated me. The other writer who influenced me tremendously was William Faulkner. And I very much liked what I read about the dysfunctionality of families, the destruction of families by secrets held within by members of the family, that sort of thing, and the whole struggle between those families and the Snopes clan. And I wanted to write something like that. So I think I probably would have carried some of those tropes over, but I can't envision exactly what form they would have taken right now, because I didn't have a clear sense of where this ought to be set, you know, until I read the Lord of the Rings.
Well, we're talking with Mr. Terry Brooks, whose new book is Bearers of the Black Staff. It seems that writers sometimes fall down into one of two camps in a broad generalized sense, which is writers who are discussing, they are addressing things happening internally, things happening inside their own consciousness or their own lives, or writers who are dealing with what Stephen King called the buried relics of a collective consciousness, which are the things of, you know, this sort of Campbellian myths and the cyclical hero's journey. Do you share the idea that some of these things are just inherent in the human psyche, and that we compulsively need to tell them, to share these stories, to explore these themes?
I would say I do. I think that the universality of storytelling is what draws readers to it. And the issues that we're dealing with now are no different than the issues we were dealing with in many respects hundreds of years ago. And the human condition hasn't changed that much, that we have all new issues to explore. So the ways in which people interact with each other, there's all kinds of things that you can do with that. And I would say that, you know, I'm more internalized, I think, as a writer, if I had to make a choice. I'm more interested in the way in which we deal with our problems and the ways in which we react and the choices we make when there are no good choices. There are only difficult and sometimes only bad choices to be made. How do we make those choices, and what do we do? And we see that every day in the lives of people around us, particularly in people in positions of power. And what does the power do to them? You know, how does this impact them? Well, many of them self-destruct. Many of them make terrible choices. And we wonder how this could happen. How could they be so foolish? You know, we understand it subconsciously, too, because we see some of that to a smaller degree in ourselves.
The sci-fi fantasy community is obviously exceptionally loyal. Does that increase or ease the pressure when you're writing a work which expands on existing tales?
Boy, there's... I don't know. You know, I put so much pressure on myself, I don't need any help from the outside world. Free time. You know, it's like you have to prove yourself all over again every time you write a book. That's the way I feel about it. You know, you're only as good as your last book, that whole concept. And I think that when you start out, you always feel that same pressure that this is the time you're going to implode. This is the time that someone is going to say, hey, the emperor's got no clothes.
Yeah, they're going to...
masquerading.
Do you share that apprehension that many artists have that you will this is it, the jig is up, and they're going to figure out that I've just sort of been faking my way through this entire thing?
I do, and I always reach a point in every book I write, somewhere in the halfway mark, maybe 6 months into it, 8 months into it, something like that, where I am convinced I have written the biggest piece of crap known to man. And I look at it and I think, how in the world could I deceive myself? And I have to walk away from it for maybe a week, and then I come back and I realize it's okay, it's not really that bad. Or, you know, that I've written about a character that is just totally unbelievable, or something like that. But there's those checkpoint moments where you say to yourself, are you kidding yourself here, or has this really got any merit? And that kind of thing is good, I think, if you're a writer. You need to have that, because it's too easy to fall into the trap of thinking that every word you write is golden. And you don't have to. I have an agreement with my editors. I've only had three in all this time, and the agreement has always been the same. I said, I want you to treat me like I've never written anything. You know, don't come in there and think, well, I'm dealing with a writer who's written 20 books, so, or 25 books or whatever, so I don't have to worry so much. I don't want you to do that. I want you to be really, really tough on me, because I need that.
And
every writer needs that. You need to be questioned about what you're doing each time out.
Is it possible to forget the fact that you've sold, 21 million, I can't even fathom that, 21 million books? Do you have to just sort of shut that off in your mind and not even recognize it before, you know, you can really get down to work?
Yeah, you really do. And I do a number of things for that. You know, I don't do a lot of public appearances, number one, which is the bane of everybody's existence. I'm lucky to be married to a woman who is an avid reader and who keeps me honest about, and she's my first reader, keeps me honest about what I'm writing, and who's very good about saying, if you're done now, honey, why don't you come take the garbage out? Bring you right back down so you don't think that you've got anything special going on in your life beyond what's reasonable.
I read somewhere that it took you 7 years to write Sword of Shannara because you were attending law school and then you were practicing law and practiced law for some time, even after becoming an author. Did you enjoy it?
In fact, I enjoyed it enough, and it stabilized me enough when I was working on the first six books, that I actually considered not quitting. Because I was afraid that I would have too much freedom and I would, not be able to function the way that I could under the tighter restraints of having to spend, 40, 50 hours a week practicing law and then writing on the side. That was a myth, of course, but I did think about that at the time.
As a member of the International Brotherhood of Geeks, I suppose, I have to ask, when you wrote the novelization of The Phantom Menace, what was that experience like? Were you given essentially a free hand, or were there a lot of strictures put on that by either formally or informally when you created that novelization? How free were you to do what you wanted?
I was pretty free. I got a lot of good respect and help from George Lucas and the LucasArts people, and they basically... I had a long meeting with him right in the beginning because I'd had a horrible experience working on the novelization of the movie Hook, and I sworn I wasn't going to do anything like that again. So I decided I really had to sit down and talk with him about it. And he was very good about saying, all of the people there that I talked with were very good about saying, whatever you need, you're going to get it. You can just ask for it. And when I talked to George face-to-face, he had some ideas about what he wanted to see happen with the book. He told me that if I could incorporate them, that would be good. One of them was he wanted to see more about Anakin Skywalker as a character than he'd been able to do in the movie. He wanted to develop it further. We talked about adding some things that weren't in the movie. He said that'd be great. Add whatever you want. If I take something out, you can put it back in. I don't care. I asked him if I could change his dialogue. you know, long pause as I said that. And he said, I don't care, change it. You know, as long as you don't destroy the story, you can do anything you want. And he was very good about it. And I did, you know, I did change quite a bit with it and got a lot of background in that wasn't in the movie that he told me about. And he changed almost nothing.
If it makes you feel any better, I should say that almost everyone had a bad experience with the movie Hook. So that movie really made no one happy in any way at all.
You know what was terrible about that, Rick, was that I saw the original script before they totaled it. And it was an excellent script. It was going to be good. And then about 2 minutes after I came aboard, they got rid of the screenwriter and started to change it, and it just went straight downhill.
Terry Brooks will be appearing at 7 p.m. at Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing this Wednesday. That's at the intersection of Cedar Hills Boulevard and Hall. Thank you for spending some time with us, and best of continued success in life, art, and all things, my friend.
Hey, Rick, you're very kind. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, sir.